the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And greetings. I'm John Loeffler, and our guest today on the program is Dr. Jack Wolfson. His book is The Paleocardiologist, The Natural Way to Heart Health. And this is an important issue because a lot of people, for about 50% of the men, say, for example, that have heart attacks, the first indication that they might be having some coronary trouble is sudden death. Now, obviously, after that, it's very hard to heal anything. And I've known people who, had they taken care of their heart health early on, wouldn't have been suffering for so much heart problems later on. You know, one issue we cover here on the program is health, because some people are taking that seriously due to advances in medicine, and especially not just in medicine, but in the idea that people are taking care of their health. Some people are catching on to this. People are living longer. According to Social Security, a male age 65 has a life expectancy of 17.6 years. Living to about 82 and a half years. A woman age 65 has a life expectancy of 20.26 years. That's not fair. They outlive us, or roughly till about age 85. So retired couples are living longer, and statistics show that there is a 50% chance that you could live to be age 90. Now, that's good news. You're living longer, and that means we spend more of our life in retirement. But see, there's some bad news here to it. According to the latest studies, many retirees, over 50%, will experience a lower standard of living during retirement. And for some, they will outlive their assets. That's the real bad part. And they go broke. So can you keep your assets going to get you through your retirement years? Today, we're going to cover strategies to help avoid this very serious predicament.
You know, we've covered this issue, John, in a number of programs here on the program, especially what we call the withdrawal rates. We had Dr. Wayne Fowle. We talked about the 4% withdrawal rule. For many of you, or let's say first-time listeners, the 4% rule is, let's say the average couple spends 25 years in retirement. If you withdraw 4% of your principal, technically, that should last you 25 years. You die the last day, and you live perfectly. Well, that is widely used in the industry as a standard. Here's the problem. In an era of financial repression, and after last week's Fed meeting, it looks like low interest rates are going to be here for some time, and not to mention the fact that we've had two bear markets, it's changed the retirement outcomes. I mean, we really have, John, today, a perfect storm developing in retirement. First, longevity. People are living longer. The statistics you just mentioned from the Department of Social Security. Secondly, as a result of living longer, people are facing rising medical costs. And three, low investment returns. We live in a world of 0% interest rates. Now, given this environment, it calls for a much, much different strategy to avoid outliving your assets during retirement. I mean, if we go back to the days that Social Security was put into place in 1933, the average life expectancy of a male was 65. Now it's more likely getting close to 85. So people are living much, much longer in retirement. As a result, they're finding themselves not only facing lower living standards, in many cases, John, really outliving their assets and going broke.
Okay, what are the safe withdrawal rates now, given this low interest rate environment? I mean, the Fed just told us middle of last week, if you recall, this is going to be a slow grind raising interest rates that maybe, you know, 2017, 2018, before they get interest rates to normal levels, which means at least for this year, they'll probably do a change once in September and then forget it for a while. Here's what Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen said last week.
From the point of view of savers, of course, this has been a very difficult period. Many retirees, and I hear from some almost every day, are really suffering from low rates that they had anticipated would bolster their retirement income. This you know, obviously has been one of the adverse consequences of a period of low rates. We have a good reason for having kept rates at the levels that we have. Our charge from Congress is to pursue the goals of maximum employment and price stability. That's what we've been doing. And obviously there are benefits from a strong economy to every household in the economy, including savers, from having a better job market and a more secure economy. But yes, when the time comes for us to raise rates, I think there will be some benefits that flow through to savers.
Yeah, that was Janet Yellen last week.
You know, there have been a number of studies on the 4% rule, the withdrawal rates for a number of years. And, you know, it all depends on life expectations, but it uses a combination of withdrawal rates, and it's paired with stock allocation. So the 4% rule, you were not to put all your assets in one basket like fixed income or a bond fund. And generally, there are two things that they have found when studying withdrawal rates and the success of not running into this issue. Generally, the longer the time frame, the lower the withdrawal rate and the higher the stock allocation. Now, think about that for a moment. If you are going to live a longer period of time that you're looking at, obviously your principal has to last you for a number of more years than, let's say, a shorter time span. And we know over a longer period of time, the cost of living goes up. So that's why they recommend a higher percentage in stock allocation. For example, if we only had a 10-year period, the withdrawal rate could be close to 9%. The equity allocation is close to 40%. One of the reasons they have that higher percentage is because of the latter years, the higher medical expenses. If we're looking at 20 years, the withdrawal rate can be 5%. The allocation to stocks could be 30% or 30% in stocks. If you're looking at 25 years, you're looking at a withdrawal rate of little over 4% with an equity allocation to stocks. These are blue chip dividend paying stocks of about 45%. You're looking at 45 years, 40 and 45 years. And John, there have been people that have retired in their 50s, lived into their 90s. But anyway, if you're looking at 40 years, you're looking at an allocation of about 65%. So it really is a time horizon question. The longer the time horizon requires lower withdrawal rates or initial withdrawal rates. And obviously, with a shorter time horizon, you can have a higher withdrawal rate with less income, let's say, allocated to the stock market. So really, you need to look at time horizons when you're thinking about this and planning in retirement. And we're going to get to what I think is a much more safer method of handling this issue than just, you know, coming out and say, all right, I have X amount of assets and I'm going to take X percent every single year. I mean, think if you did that in the year 2000 ahead of the bear market. And also when interest rates came down to 1% by 2004. Think if you did that in the financial crisis of 2007 and 9, or where we are today, where we've been at 0% interest rates for almost 7 years now. So an evaluation of life expectancies is almost a must. You know, taking a look at family history, your current health issues, it's imperative if you're going to make a proper decision to take a look at, hey, you know, we have a history of longevity in our family, or no, that's not an issue, or maybe you are dealing with a serious health issue yourself. And so you really need to look at that first. There are a number of other issues, but, you know, one of the things that we're looking at is a time horizon. How long can you expect to live in retirement? Not just yourself, but your spouse as well, if you're married.
Okay, so if we begin with a reasonable look at health history and your age, et cetera, your retirement seems in good standing. Do you pat yourself on the head and go away? But then what?
I hate to say this, but if you really want to do a good job of planning for retirement, you're going to have to start with a budget. It's just as important as looking at health and your time horizons. And as listeners know, we take that budget and we break it down into two components. And this is very key to never having to worry about outliving your assets. We have a basic budget, which is the cost of living. That's your house payment, your rent, your food, your utilities, your medical bills, insurance premiums, gasoline, all those things that cost you to live on a daily basis. And that's your basic budget. And then we have what we call the bucket list. That's what you want to do. It's travel, vacations, hobbies, helping children, the kind of fun stuff you'd like to do, buying toys. Maybe you want a motorhome. Maybe you want a boat, or, you know, whatever it is that you like doing, or joining a country club, playing golf, or, you know, for a lot of people, it's really travel. So what you want to do if you want to have a secure retirement is you want to target your basic living expenses, the bulk of what you spend money on, with a target guaranteed income that you cannot outlive. And if you can do that, it greatly increases your chances of not outliving your assets. So it is a more purposeful approach rather than taking some blanket percentage. Because had you taken those blanket percentages, how many people back in the year 2000 could foresee what we would go through in the last decade with the bursting of the tech bubble, bringing down interest rates as Greenspan did, then the housing bubble, then the financial crisis, and then ZERP, or 0% interest rates, which is the environment that we find ourselves in today. I mean, these things were not thought of 15 years ago. And that's why I don't like this approach of just taking, okay, I have X amount of dollars and we're just going to take a percent and just hope it all works out well.
Well, what are the assets or income streams that are going to provide this guarantee or assurance? I would guess an obvious one would be a pension plan or Social Security.
We basically look at four areas if we want to target basic expenses with some kind of degree of confidence or assurance that you're never going to have to worry about outliving them. And we basically look at four areas. You mentioned one of them, pensions. You know, you work for the state, you work for the city, you're a teacher, or you work for the government. And there's still corporations today that give their employees pensions after so many years of service. So pensions is one of them. Second is Social Security. Because if you get a pension, usually from a company, from the state or government or a company, it's going to last you or your spouse for your entire lifetime. So you're not going to outlive that. Likewise with Social Security. The other two areas that we look at are fixed income portfolios, which are basically a laddered bond portfolio, or we look at annuities. And what we find, we can use Social Security or fixed income and annuities to target basic expenses. And then what we use for inflation to handle, you know, the cost of living increases and especially healthcare in the latter years. That's why when you use a 10-year horizon, the equity allocation is a little bit higher because they're usually basing that on somebody that's older to handle inflation and future healthcare costs. But John, those are the four areas that we generally try to use to achieve those kind of objectives and make sure, because really what you're trying to do is say, you know, on a day-to-day basis, this is what it costs me to live, and the more sources of guaranteed income that will last you and your entire lifetime, the better off you're going to be.
Is there some kind of a combination you could use of these? I mean, you know, when we invest, we talk about diversity. What about coming up with a workable combination of these scenarios? Because it seems like most individuals in the private sector no longer have guaranteed pensions. That was something that drifted backwards in time as they were really replaced by the 401k programs.
The first area that we try to focus on, which is available to most people that worked in the private sector, is Social Security. And what we want to do is we want to maximize Social Security benefits, from getting our clients to wait till full retirement age where they get the full benefit of Social Security, because number one, you're going to get 25% more than at age 62. Secondly, once you reach full retirement age, you can work, whether it's full-time or part-time, and not get penalized under full retirement age. So that's very important. We use options like file and suspend, where let's say a older spouse or the main breadwinner may file, allowing his wife to get half of his Social Security, and then allow his Social Security to compound at 8% a year for four more years. And that does a number of things. Number one, it's a bigger check at age 70. Number two, it allows his wife to do something called file and restrict, where she basically says, look, I'm going to take my husband's Social Security right now, but I want mine to compound at that 8% growth rate each year until I can take it. And that does a couple of things. Number one, it would allow a situation where even if the husband lives longer, by allowing to file and suspend, he's going to have a larger check at age 70. And that's important because his wife, should he pass away, could take his Social Security instead of her own or a half of his, and the check is larger. So we're always going to try to focus on maximizing Social Security benefits. Then, depending on the amount of assets that are available, we will use things like fixed income if the assets are there to provide the income. If not, then we are more likely to use an annuity combination with Social Security to try and get coverage of all basic expenses. And John, we have found this to be much more successful. Dr. Wade Fow from American College, one of the nation's probably leading experts on retirement planning, found immediate annuities combined with blue chip dividend paying stocks to be a very successful approach to meeting these income needs in today's investment environment. And he's been featured in Barron's. In fact, he was just interviewed in Barron's just about a month ago, talking about this very concept of the percentage withdrawal rates versus like annuities and dividend paying stocks and also the traditional 4% approach.
You know, essentially, it looks like the annuity is actually fulfilling a role of bonds, but unlike bonds, it provides an income stream like a pension you cannot live.
And really, an immediate annuity essentially does become a replacement for a pension, and it really is no different. Let's say you retired from a company or you retired from the government. What happens is when a person works for a company and you get ready to retire and they say, you know, we're going to offer you a retirement package based on your years of service. We're going to give you X percentage of your salary for your life or a different level of income if it's going to be both you and your spouse. Well, what that company did is they were putting money aside each year. They're required to fund these programs, and they put that money aside just like you're putting money into a 401k program. But then when you get to retirement, they have a pot of money that they've set aside for you. And what they're essentially going to do is take that pot of money, go to an insurance company and say, this is your age. This is the age of your spouse. With this pot of money, what would you give this person as a monthly income for the rest of their life and that of their spouse? It's no different with immediate annuity. So what annuity does, in effect, is provide a replacement for a lack of a pension. And when you combine it with Social Security, what you now have is a secure source of income that essentially you're going to create and you cannot outlive. Social Security will pay you income, both you and your spouse, until the day you pass on. Likewise with an annuity, it's going to do the same. Likewise, just like a company pension plan. So really, John, what you hit upon it, really, you're creating your own pension with a immediate annuity.
All right, that sounds positive for most of what we've discussed so far. Any disadvantages in this? I mean, there seems to be a downside to everything. So where are the pitfalls and what would you have to watch out for?
Well, I mean, first of all, one disadvantage of an immediate annuity, it's no different when you get a pension from a company, is it doesn't provide for inflation. Now, here in California, I know teachers, I think they get up to 2% COLA increase, and we know Social Security has a COLA component. An immediate annuity is like a pension. It does not provide for inflation. The other disadvantage is foregoing principal and, in some cases, liquidity, although today there are immediate annuities that offer a liquidity feature in case, you know, something comes up, an unexpected medical expense where you can have access to some of that principal. But those are probably the two main disadvantages right now.
Well, giving up the principal is no different than what happens when an individual retires, for example, and takes a guaranteed pension from an employer or an education system or a government pension. They're guaranteed for life, but it stops at the death of the first or the last spouse. So at some point it is discontinued. It doesn't transfer on. So what's the advantage of an annuity versus bonds? I mean, why not just a bond portfolio?
There's no way today in today's low interest rate world where you can match the cash flow returns, predictability, or the guarantees of an annuity. You just can't. I mean, think about people that went into bond funds in the year 2000. Did they ever think that they'd be looking at interest rates at almost 0%? And, you know, cash flow is significantly higher with an immediate annuity, and it can make a world of difference for a couple who may not have, let's say, the sufficient assets to cover their living expenses and who also don't want to take the risk of, let's say, investing in, let's say, high-risk assets like junk bonds today in order to get a higher rate of return. So what you're trying to do with this option is provide an income stream that will last you or your spouse your entire life versus, let's say, taking the risk of drawing down your principal. Even with a laddered bond portfolio, I can't predict right now, and I don't think anybody can, where interest rates are going to be 10, 15, 20 years. Just look at the last 15 years. Would any of you have thought we would be where we are today? What are we going in year 7 where the Fed funds rate has been at 0.25%? Or looking at money market funds that pay you zero? You just can't do that, where the annuity takes the risk of longevity in investment and places it on the insurance company. That's what insurance companies do.
All right, so using Social Security and an immediate annuity, you target your basic living expenses so you can't outlive the income stream. Now, what about inflation? Because there's always these things that, as you mentioned, you can't predict.
You know, I don't care if you're looking at the 4% withdrawal rule, if you're looking at using immediate annuities with Social Security, this approach works best when combined with blue chip dividend paying stocks. And Dr. Pfau at American University did a number of studies, and this was the combination that worked the best. The dividend increases each year become your inflation hedge for those later years in life when you know you're going to be spending, I call it almost like a sandwich when it comes to expenses. You know, a lot of expenses in the early years, when you first retire, you're taking those trips and traveling, especially when you're in good health, that you didn't have the time to do, let's say, in your working career. Then, when you get into the latter part of your retirement years, that's where you're really forking out the big bucks for health insurance premiums, medical expenses, prescription drugs, God forbid, long-term care. So this is where the good dividend-paying stocks generally not only pay you an increasing income stream, but generally, when you keep increasing the dividends year after year, they generally appreciate over time. And this is important, not only as an inflation hedge, but also replacing principal used as a result of creating a guaranteed income stream with the annuity. And the studies, once again, have been done over and over again, not just at American College. It has been a found, John, by far one of the most effective strategies to use.
But I know we've done a number of shows talking about dividend stocks as a real good hedge against inflation. And I think that people actually mistake stock market fluctuations with income fluctuations. Just because a stock may correct or go down doesn't mean that the income goes down at the same time. In most cases, blue chip stocks increase their dividends even in a financial crisis or in bear markets like the market we had in 2000 or in 2007 to 2009. So why don't you contrast this for people? This is important that people understand this difference to illustrate what we're talking about using these as an inflation hedge.
What I'm going to do in this illustration, what I did is I took a couple consumer product companies, an energy company, and utilities, because one of the things that if you study dividend paying stocks and, you know, just study Warren Buffett, you know, what did he do? He just bought Kraft, he bought Heinz, he bought a railroad, he bought energy companies. He buys and invests in things that people have to have and use on a daily basis. He doesn't want to be subject to the vagaries of the economy. So what I did is I took four companies, Coca-Cola, Exxon, Procter & Gamble, and a utility company, Piedmont Natural Gas. And you can do this with probably most of the Dow stocks. The one exception were the financials as a result of the financial crisis in 2007. But I went back to the year 2000, and I took it in five-year increments, 2000, 2005, 2010, and then this year, 2015. And starting out with Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola paid a dividend of 34 cents in the year 2000. By 2005, it had risen to 56. Now, remember, that was during the bear market and recession that we had in 2001. By 2010, the dividend was 88 cents, and today it's $1.32. You take a company like Exxon, paid 88 cents in 2000, $1.14 in 2005, 2010 it was up to $1.74, and by 2015 it was $2.88. Procter & Gamble, 64 cents in 2000, $1.03 in 2005, $1.80 in 2010, and $2.60 in 2015. And finally, you know, just old stodgy natural gas utility like Piedmont, 72 cents in 2000, by 2015 it was $1.31. The point here is, even though the stock price can fluctuate, and this is what confuses people, or the myth that people have, they think, oh, if the stock price is down, my income's down. That's not true. They can fluctuate, but even through bear markets, Coca-Cola has increased its dividend every single year, along with Procter & Gamble, along with Piedmont, along with Exxon. The dividends rose each year along with the stock price over time, and that is why so many studies have validated, John, this approach.
All right, so the most important thing we've always said is, when you're planning for retirement, you have to create a budget, your essential living costs, and you can even project them forward maybe with some inflation. But at least start with a base of today and say, if today were today and I were to retire and everything would stay flat for the most part, what would I need to retire on in terms of just basic expenses? Then you have to target that budget with secure guaranteed income. And depending on your assets, it could be Social Security, pensions, bonds, or annuities. But it is also important to provide an inflation hedge, and studies show that the dividend stocks make for a great inflation hedge. So those are the important things that you have to remember in bringing this all together. Now, we want to show you how this works in a real-world study. We do this every week on lifetime income. This is a real-world case study. The names have been changed to protect the privacy of the people involved, but the study is a real-life event.
This week's case study is Larry and Clara Clancy. Larry, age 74. His wife, Clara, was age 72. They had lived and worked, and Larry had lived and worked in New York. They retired to Tampa, Florida, as many people on the East Coast do. The situation here was kind of unusual. The main investment was a commercial building that was owned in New Jersey that Larry inherited from his father. Now, up to the time it was sold, it was providing almost $20,000 a month. The value of the property was about $3 million. One of the issues is the tenant, who had been his tenant for almost 15 years, said, you know what, I want to buy this thing, and if you don't sell it to me, I'm going to move someplace else. And so he would have had the problem trying to find a predictable tenant, which is a big issue if you own a commercial property. So long story short, they sold the building to the tenant, sold it for $3 million. Of course, as you know, if you own real estate, your cost basis drops every year by depreciation. So there was a significant capital gain in this issue. Capital gains taxes at the federal level was $750,000. Capital gains taxes on real estate are higher than regular stock and bond. So the problem was, this now left $2.2 million after taxes. And the issue was, you know, how are you going to replace, number one, almost a third of the asset just disappeared in the form of taxes. Number two, there was just no way his income of almost $20,000 a month on the commercial property without the taxes at $3 million was equivalent to almost 8% return. And I just told Larry, I said, look, you know, even if we had $3 million, it would really be hard to get a guaranteed or predictable rate of return of 8% a year like you were getting when you were renting the building. I said, now, get rid of $750,000. There's just no way I'm going to be able to cover that with anything that is safe and predictable, and especially given two issues. One, your age, and two, longevity running on both sides of your family.
All right, do they have any other sources of income?
Yeah, I mean, they had $220,000 of IRAs between both Larry and Clara that they were drawing on, because both of them were over age 70, so they were having to take mandatory distributions. They had $27,000 in Social Security. The problem was their expenses were $132,000 a year, and after building sale, that would have left a shortfall of roughly about $105,000 that we had to come and make up as a result of the sale of the building and the loss of the rental income.
You know, I thought Florida was a relatively cheap place to live.
Well, I mean, a lot of the budget, as we see in many cases today, $40,000 of that was travel expenses. Being on the East Coast, they traveled to Europe a lot, and they spent a good part of their budget on travel. And the other thing is, they were spending almost $20,000 a year, $10,000 each, to each one of their daughters. So, I mean, if you really look at it, their base budget was $70,000. Well, we took a look at all kinds of options. I looked at bond funds. We looked at writing covered calls on stocks. And there was nothing I could tell Larry and Clara that was going to be predictable, as his rent was from his tenant over a 15-year period of time. Another advisor had recommended a whole bunch of bond funds, but they were emerging market debt. They were high-risk things like junk bonds. I said, do you really want to take your principal and put it in an area? And even then, it wasn't going to be sufficient enough to provide him with income. So what we ended up doing is we put $1 million in an immediate annuity with a liquidity clause, a 10-year certain, meaning that if something should happen to them within 10 years, they would continue those payments within a 10-year period. There was a liquidity provision in it. That would provide them an income of $5,000 a month. That would be $60,000 a year. The other $1.25 million, we put in dividend-paying blue-chip stocks, roughly at a 3% dividend. That was about $44,000 a year. And then the withdrawal rates that they were taking from their IRAs, that was $9,000. You add that to their $27,000 that they were already getting from Social Security, John, and the income turned out to be $140,000 against expenses of $132,000. So we were able to do it, but the only way that we were able to do this predictably was with an immediate annuity, and especially in a situation where you had, given their age, we didn't want to take a lot of risk. Secondly, longevity running on both sides, they never wanted to get themselves in a situation where they were actually withdrawing principal and spending down their principal, which, you know, can be rather frightening when you get into your 70s and your parents live long on both sides and you're thinking, you know, I could live into my 90s too. Do I really want to be spending my principal? So we use the combination of an immediate annuity to replace and, in effect, create a pension or come close to what he was getting from rent, and then combined with the dividend-paying stocks, which also would increase over time. We had the inflation hedge, and also we had the ability to make up the principal that would be foregone when both Larry and Clara passed on with the immediate annuity.
Basically, what's happening here is that the blue-chip dividend-paying stocks would enable them to live into their 90s because it would grow, and it would replace some of the original $1 million principal that they had lost.
Yeah, I mean, we did a couple of provisions to protect. Number one, we created 10-year certain. All that means is should both of them pass away before 10 years, those payments would continue to their heirs. We also, this was really important for Larry, we added the liquidity provision. He just wanted to have that, even though we had, you know, between the $1.25 million, between his bank account, between almost $250,000 in their IRAs, he had enough. He just wanted to make sure that that provision was there. He'll never use it, but he wanted to make sure that that was there anyway. And so we created the liquidity provision, the certainty provision. And the thing that they liked the most is they both came from long-lived families. And so this was very important to them with longevity into their mid-90s. So we wanted to make sure they didn't outlive their assets. And we also needed to replace that rental income without taking big risk. I pointed out, you know, one of the proposals given to them is you take a look at, yeah, there's one reason why they were getting 4% and 5% returns or 5.5%. They were all high risk bond funds. And none of those bond funds, as anybody knows, the income from a bond fund isn't guaranteed. So this was also important to them.
And with another success story under our belts, time to hear from your guest today, Dr. Jack Wolfson. The Paleocardiologist is the book, The Natural Way to Heart Health. Coming up next, as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Each year, the number one killer in the United States has been heart disease. And yet, after decades and decades of medical advancement, we're still losing the vast majority of Americans each year to heart disease. Is it an issue of diet? Is it an issue of just improper care, lack of exercise? We're finding out more and more. It has a lot to do with the food we eat. Joining me on the program is Dr. Jack Wolfson. He's author of a new book called The Paleocardiologist, A Natural Way to Heart Health. Doctor, what is it that we are now learning about diet? And even when it comes to diet, there's so many confusing number of views on the Mediterranean diet, the Atkins diet. We're obviously talking about the paleo diet, becoming a vegetarian, vegans. We're finding out today that diet play such an important role in our health?
Well, Jim, that's a great question. The reality is that there's only two things which cause disease: poor nutrition and chemicals. And if we make it real simple like that, I think it's real easy for people to understand. And that by changing those two things in your life, you're going to have extraordinary heart health, and you're going to avoid cancer and diabetes and dementia and on and on. And as you said, there's a lot of different diets that are out there, but paleo is really about eating what our ancestors did when they were hunter-gatherers and doing so in a modern world. And when we do that, our patients are enjoying phenomenal health. Their blood work looks fantastic. People feel great. And it's really been empowering to me to be able to do that, to really go after the cause of people's health problems.
I want to talk about when it comes to a diet, and especially when it comes to heart disease. We've heard so much from drug companies, the medical professions about cholesterol. You know, we have statin drugs that lower your cholesterol. Let's talk about cholesterol in the role that it plays. It's not the bad guy that many people think it is.
Oh, you're absolutely correct, Jim. When I do lectures in front of hundreds of people and tell them, what is cholesterol? I ask that question, what is cholesterol? And people raise their hand and they say, oh, well, it's bad. It causes heart attacks. It causes plaque. It blockages. I say, well, that is very far from the truth. The reality is that cholesterol, every single cell in our body makes it. Our liver makes it. And we need it for life. We cannot live without it. Cholesterol forms all of our sex hormones, such as testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. It forms vitamin D in our bodies. It's important for digestion. It forms every single cell in our body has a cell membrane that is like a fence that holds things inside the cell and keeps things out of the cell that do not belong. And cholesterol is a big part of that membrane. So it's been vilified over the years, but incorrectly so. And that's really why I labeled my first chapter in my book is called Cholesterol is King. Because once people understand the importance of cholesterol and we tear down those theories that have been given to us by medical doctors, then it opens up people's eyes to, hey, what else does this guy have to say? Now that he said cholesterol is not a big thing and that I need it, what else is important for heart health?
Well, let's talk about the role. Your second chapter in your book is called LDL is Not the Boogeyman. Explain what you mean by that, and what are the differences in roles between, let's say, HDL and LDL?
Well, I grew up in the 1970s, and the horror movies at the time that were so popular was all about the boogeyman, and I guess that's what I kind of link in it now to when doctors talk about the bad LDL cholesterol and the good HDL cholesterol. When the reality is that we as humans and every other animal has LDLs and HDLs, and they serve a purpose. The LDL is the bus that carries cholesterol, fat-soluble vitamins, phospholipids that are critical for brain function, CoQ10, which is so important for energy production. Those things travel around the body inside of the LDL bus, and that bus delivers the passengers where it's needed. So, for example, if your body wants to make more cortisol for energy, then the LDL bus travels down to the adrenal glands above the kidneys and drops off cholesterol. And there, from there, cholesterol is transformed into cortisol. So we want to emphasize the importance of the LDL. And there are tests that we do that determines, do you have a lot of high-quality LDLs that are large, buoyant, fluffy LDLs, or do you have small, damaged, dense LDLs, and you can measure that, and those measurements are very important for any treating physician, but the unfortunate fact is most doctors do not test that kind of breakdown. They just test for a total LDL content, and at the worst, what's happening now is that they're basically just kind of saying, everybody over a certain age, take your statin drugs, and don't even worry about what your cholesterol is. They've gotten rid of that even as a goal, but it really is very important to have that kind of knowledge.
Yeah, because one of the things you point out in your book, there are different kinds of cholesterol, the fat, fluffy kind and the other kind, and the difference between the two is really at the heart of much of this problem.
Well, certainly. And what leads to these small, dense, nasty, bad guys is really going to be poor nutrition that does it. The people that are eating tons of carbs, lots of sugar, certainly foods that are inflammatory, like a lot of the grains and certainly the gluten-containing grains, they tend to have a lot of small, dense LDLs. But the people that are following paleo nutrition, and let me just say paleo is all about eating tons of vegetables, nuts and seeds, eggs, avocados, coconuts, everything's organic, the meat is free-range, grass-fed, the seafood is wild. The people that follow that their numbers look outstanding. The inflammation comes down, and most importantly, people are feeling great.
Let's talk about the role of this diet and also the role of inflammation. I think, Doctor, a lot of our listeners would be surprised to find out that almost 80% of the cause of many of our diseases today stems from the gut.
The gut, this is never discussed in medical school, Jim. You know, we didn't talk about nutrition when I was in medical school, residency, fellowship. That's just never addressed. But the gut is the barrier from the outside world to our inside world. And whether we're eating or we're drinking, yes, it is all going through that gut barrier. And if we're taking in foods that are unhealthy, unnatural, and not what our bodies are made for, then the gut becomes inflamed. And when the gut is inflamed or on fire or damaged, however you want to say it and define it, the body is irritated. And that irritation shows up in the blood work, and it translates into increased cardiovascular risk. So healing the gut by removing the things that do not belong, putting in the things that do belong, taking in the right supplements to help you get to where you need to be, that's going to give you your best chance to prevent any form of disease.
Where did we go wrong when it came to nutrition? Because the government had its own standards. You know, you had so much milk, you had so much bread, you had some vegetables, you had some meat. And gosh, as long as I can remember, Doctor, for the last three decades, there have been diet fads that have come through. The Mediterranean diet, the South Beach diet. I mean, we're constantly getting new kind of diets. But yet when you go to the store, you take a look at where people spend their money. They spend their money on processed food. They spend their money on packaged food, which cost a heck of a lot more. It makes them less healthy. Where did we go wrong? And why isn't there a central common body of knowledge that comes out and says, you know what? These are the foods that make you healthy. These are the foods that make you unhealthy. If you eat a lot of the unhealthy stuff, here's the consequences.
Well, I think that's a great point. Health is kind of like politics or religion. There's so many different factions, and everybody thinks that they're right. And once again, nutrition is no different. But paleo, in my mind, and my paleo pyramid, where the foundation is vegetables, and as we talked about, the free-range grass-fed meats and wild seafood, et cetera, and all the organics, that to me just makes the most amount of sense because that's what our ancestors have been eating for millions of years. The government food pyramid, as you stated, the largest section on their food pyramid is the grain section, where they recommend eating 6 to 11 servings of grain per day. When our hunter-gatherer ancestors for hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years, never ate those foods. Now, why is that in the government's food pyramid? Well, that's when we can start talking about corporate America and the makers and purveyors of those foods. That, just like you said, they are cheap to make, expensive to sell, very addictive because of what carbohydrates and sugar does to the brain, and they have a long shelf life. So the grocers are very happy with those as opposed to perishable things that are on paleo hunter-gatherer food. You can have a box of cereal sitting on your store shelf, you know, for years, and everyone knows, of course, about Twinkies and things like that that never age, you know, over 30 years. So I think it really comes down to what happened 40, 50 years ago and the government's recommendations that were basically false, they were fraudulent, and we as a generation have suffered the consequences in the form of all the different diseases that we have today, from heart disease to cancer to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
What are the long-term effects? Let's say that you've been on this kind of diet. Now you become more knowledgeable. You take a look at, I mean, let's talk about the damaging things that people do, and that is, for example, sugar. You see it in soft drinks. You see it in food additives. You know, when you start reading labels and you start looking at the amount of things that they put in, from preservatives to the use of corn, what makes these things so bad? Is it the inflammation and the way your body processes the intake of these kind of foods?
Well, there's no doubt that these foods are pro-inflammatory. People have issues with gluten. They have issues with other proteins and nutrients that are found in non-paleo foods, such as wheat, barley, rye, even the non-gluten-containing grains. They're irritating. They're inflammatory. The body's on fire. And when the body's on fire, it produces a lot of things to try and reduce the fire and reduce the inflammation. And one of those things it does is lays down coronary artery disease. But coronary artery disease is also an autoimmune disease. It's the body attacking itself, very similar to thyroid disease, very similar to rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. When the body is taking in these nutrients, then it tries to fight that by producing antibodies, and then those antibodies start to attack other parts of the system, including the heart and the brain, and that's where we see a lot of those issues.
How would you explain, for example, one of the problems that we have in retirement today, people are living longer. So despite poor diets, pesticides, chemicals, people are living longer. Doctor, what's keeping us alive?
Well, we may be living longer, but are we living better? And that's really the main thing, is that you can keep people alive for a long period of time doing all these heroic measures. You know, you can keep people alive in an intensive care unit for years on artificial life support. We saw that with the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon. He had a stroke and he was in a coma for years, and he was kept alive for years, which is probably something that he would not have wanted if you would have asked him when he was fighting in the military for Israel for all those years. What keeps people alive longer is we've got much better sanitation. Our country is a cleaner place. We have access to the best food on the planet. We've got access to clean water, and that's really what's keeping people alive longer. It's certainly not the pharmaceuticals. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. It may be improvement, you know, once again, in the quality of medical care in an emergency situation is certainly the best it's ever been. So if there's trauma, we have abilities to keep people alive longer on trauma. But it's not that we're doing anything better magically with pharmaceuticals, really. We haven't caused much of a dent as far as chemotherapy is concerned, and the war against cancer that Nixon declared 45 years ago, we haven't made much of an impact regarding cancer. We certainly haven't made much of an impact when it comes to cardiovascular disease. All of the stents and the bypass surgeries and the procedures we're doing, it really has made a minimal impact. The pharmaceuticals are making a minimal impact. We can do so much better, you know, without all this high-tech medical stuff by eating the right foods and avoiding the chemicals.
Well, let's talk about two things used in American medicine today. That's a pill in surgery. A large amount of money is spent on, I don't care if it's bypass surgery, removing body organs, doing something surgically, and then giving a pill. I mean, it's, what, a $1 trillion business?
Yeah, it's really amazing. When I was in my old practice, there was 40 other cardiologists and surgeons in the group. You have a 10-minute office visit. Hey, Jim, how you doing? How you feeling? How's your cholesterol doing? Here's your prescription refill. Goodbye. Get a stress test on your way out. That's the kind of care we provide in the 10-minute office visit. And we actually need to demand more from our physicians to actually inform us as to what is the correct way to do it, what's the correct nutrition, what's the correct supplements, what are the lifestyle changes that I have to make. But the reality is that doctors, they don't have time for that. They don't create time for it. And it's all about the pills and the procedures. And I think it's kind of sad. I think it's sad for a modern-day doctor, a modern-day cardiologist who went through all that training, and the only thing they have to help people is prescription drugs. Here's drugs to lower your blood pressure. Here's drugs for your cholesterol. Take an aspirin. That's all they have. That's all the training that we get. And it's just so unfortunate. And I lived that for so many years, so I know what these doctors are going through. And fortunately, I had the ability to make that change, and it all came from my wife, and I made that change, and the patients are doing fantastic. But in the best case scenario, if it takes statin drugs, and I put the information in my book, I'm not saying statin drugs don't work. Statin drugs certainly have side effects, but if we say that they work, they only work by a few percentage points. So we're not about lowering someone's heart attack risk from 15% down to 13%. We want to get as close to 0% as we possibly can, and we're not going to do it with pharmaceuticals.
I want to talk about something else we don't think about, and something that surprised me in my own quest for finding better health, and that is the chemicals, the pesticides, all the pollutants that we have in our modern industrial world. One of the things that surprised me, I've been a big water drinker for almost 2 decades. I didn't realize, I never thought of, that the water that I drink comes in a plastic bottle that is a pollutant.
Right. Plastic bottles, whether or not they contain what's called BPA or they have other artificial things that are in there, other toxins and chemicals that are in there, they get into our bodies. And that's well documented, where there's a lot of companies that have the ability to test for these byproducts of plastics that should not be in the body. And they interfere with body function. They interfere with hormone function, brain function, heart function, immune function. And this is all proven. It's in the literature, but just not a lot of people are reading those things. But most doctors, once again, are just interested in the newest pill and the newest procedure. But one of the important things I stress in my book is about how to get those things out of your life. I come up with action plans at the end of every chapter about how to reduce your intake of those pollutants. But things like air pollution, indoor air pollution, dryer sheets, fabric softeners, toxic laundry detergents, colognes, perfumes, get those things out of your life and you will recover your health. Say goodbye to the migraine headaches. Say goodbye to allergies and asthma and skin disorders and stomach upsets. Get rid of all that because you don't need it.
How does one go about this? I mean, I don't think most people are even aware of some of the pollutants that are around us on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you talk about, for example, don't consume food or beverages from plastic or cans because those chemicals can get in your body. Obviously, we know about the dangers of smoking. I never really ever thought about the chemicals that are found in personal care products. You also talk about minimizing electronic devices. Let's talk about some of these things because I think a lot of our listeners are unaware of it.
Well, I think, you know, as far as, you know, changing to this form of lifestyle, it takes time. It took me time. It takes other people time. The sooner you embrace it, the sooner you're going to achieve the best health. But things like electronic devices, we don't have a lot of information about it right now. I do have a lot of patients that have problems with electromagnetic fields that are coming from electronic devices, heart rhythm issues, blood pressure issues that improve when you remove those devices from their life, especially when they're sleeping. I'm not saying unplug and totally go without, but get those things out of the bedroom. You know, you don't need to sleep next to the alarm clock or sleep next to your cell phone, and please don't go to sleep with the television on. Start to minimize some of those things in your life and you do much better. And once again, how difficult is it to change out your laundry detergent, get rid of the fabric softener, dryer sheets? These things are so easy to do. There's tons of information on my website, on my blog, and all over the internet. And there's plenty of other books that support what I'm saying. Back to the smoking issue. Yeah, sure, everyone knows that smoking is bad. But I also point out in my book that secondhand smoke is so harmful to our bodies. It kills me when I see a parent, a father, a mother smoking around their child, that poor defenseless child, and they're filling that child up full of heavy metals and toxins and pollutants that we know are so damaging. We cannot allow that to happen anymore. And there's even the concept I talk about in my book called third-hand smoke. So the father who smokes outside and says, well, I'm not smoking around my children, but those chemicals and pollutants get on the clothes, and those clothes touch other things like their children, and then the children put their hands in their mouths, and you're swallowing all those things down into your body, and it's damaging and it's harmful. We know from data where they've taken third-hand smoke byproducts and exposed rats to it, and the rats developed tumors, and the rats died. So we just have to, once again, just open up everybody's eyes to where these chemical pollutants are coming from and work every day to get rid of them.
Let's talk about reducing stress, the importance of sleep, and obviously if you've got a lot of electronic devices going on in your bedroom at night, from cell phones to Wi-Fi to computers, you know, we have so many electronic gadgets today. I mean, I think of the world that we live in today with our iPods, our iPads, our iPhones. These were things that didn't exist 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's really an interesting time, to say the least, in human evolution as far as what we are exposing our bodies to. And the answer is we just don't know. We're running just a giant experiment on ourselves, and only time will tell what the ultimate ramifications are. But in my mind, it's about living paleo in the modern world. So I'm not telling people to throw out their cell phone. I'm not telling people to get rid of their Wi-Fi. But I want people to identify that these may be a sources of health problems that they are currently having. And then also, once again, to be able to minimize your exposure for the long term. And what if a study comes out tomorrow that says, yeah, it turns out that cell phones actually do cause brain cancer or dementia? You know, we want to be proactive instead of reactive and start to minimize these things as best as we can. But, you know, turning off the television in the bedroom, unplugging in the bedroom, getting rid of your cell phone and your alarm clock, those should be pretty easy things. Move the cell phone into the bathroom. it's just not necessary to have right next to your head.
In your book, you also talk about healthy beverages. You know, I've been told a glass of red wine is good for the heart. I've even read studies that coffee is good for prevention of Alzheimer's. Let's talk about very common beverages that most of us as Americans are exposed to. Coffee, water, wine, tea.
Well, I think we'd all like to have our cake and eat it too, right? We'd all like to think that chocolate is healthy and coffee is healthy and wine is healthy. The reality is that these are not paleo foods. The problem with chocolate is that it's loaded with sugar. So if you do raw cacao, which is basically the chocolate bean, I think that that is okay. And some people, it's got a stimulatory effect to it. But when it comes to coffee, yeah, there's plenty of literature that says it's good. There's some literature that says it's bad. If you're going to drink coffee, please make it organic. When it's not organic, it was sprayed with pesticides, herbicides, and it kills bugs. That kind of stuff will kill us. So make sure it's organic, preferably decaf, and don't overdo it. But also realize that that morning cup of coffee could be a source of your health problems, whether it's headaches, whether it's sleep issues, whether it's hypertension. It can certainly be a problem. When it comes to wine, I recommend at most 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages per week. I never recommend someone start drinking when they were not drinkers. If you're looking for all the benefits of red wine, you can just eat the grapes and get all the phenols and all the nutrients from eating grapes. But, you know, alcohol is damaging to the liver. It's damaging to the heart. It's damaging to the brain, and not something that I encourage people to do.
Let's finally talk about exercise, because just like nutrition and diets, you know, I've heard things like boot camp workouts, Pilates, yoga, cardio, weightlifting. Is there a balance there, or is there anything that you have found that really works?
Well, the number one thing I would tell people when it comes to exercise or physical activity, when you say exercise, people start to stress out. It raises heart rate and blood pressure. So I like to say physical activity is to enjoy themselves. No matter where you live in the world, get outside, go for a walk, go for a bike ride, go for a jog, go for a hike. I live down here in Arizona. My family, my wife, my two boys and I, we go hiking all the time. We go on family bike rides. What an amazing experience. But I also do things to build muscle, and that is important, and it's been proven in the literature that it's important, and it really helps from a cardiovascular standpoint. So do your push-ups, do your pull-ups. I do handstands, and I do presses where I go up and down in the handstand position. If you can't do this on your own, get a trainer to help you out. You don't have to get a fancy gym membership. You don't have to get a whole set of barbells and dumbbells. You can do a lot of the stuff with your body weight, lunges, squats. On my YouTube channel, I do a little demo video. I use 1 gallon soap bottle full of liquid soap, and I do my shoulder exercises with that, and I do bicep curls. So physical activity is very important. Our paleo ancestors, they carried water, they carried their children, they carried shelter, they moved a boulder from one place to another. They had plenty of muscle mass and tone, and that's so important as we get older.
And finally, Doctor, I want to talk about supplements and vitamins. Do they really make a difference? And if so, what are the key supplements that you recommend?
Well, the evidence is there. It's in the literature that supplements are beneficial in so many different cases. Sometimes they're not proven to be beneficial in certain studies, but in other studies they are. The unfortunate reality is that as well as we eat, we can be eating paleo and organic. The problem is we didn't do it for the first 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years of our lives, and our bodies are damaged because of that. In addition, because the environment, frankly, is so polluted, we need additional support to get the job done. So the foundation of what I tell people, if you start off the day with a greens drink, and for example, we sell a greens powder that is made from dehydrated vegetables, you add water to it, it's a great way to start off the day, great thing to use as a snack. A multivitamin has a lot of literature about the benefits of a multivitamin. If the individual components work, why doesn't the multi work? Well, it does work. Omega-3 fish oil, digestive enzymes to make sure we're digesting our food and absorbing all the nutrients. Probiotics, which are the healthy bacteria that colonize our gut, like we were talking about. 80% of the immune system is housed in the gastrointestinal tract, the duodenum, the small intestine, the large intestine. These areas are all important, and you keep that healthy with good quality probiotics. Another fantastic food is fermented vegetables, things like kimchi and sauerkraut. in their raw form are just what a boost they are to your immunity and your total body health when you eat those foods. But that's why I created the chapter, Top 20 Cardiovascular Supplements. All of the information is all sourced. It is all referenced with medical journals. And I know my patients are doing very well by it.
Well, doctor, I know in my own case, I've tried diets, all kinds of things. I've been a vegetarian at one time and found out I started gaining weight. And paleo was just something that stuck and it worked. You know, I lost over 20 pounds. You know, my cholesterol levels are down. So what you're talking about in your book works. And I've seen it work with others.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I definitely agree. You know, the book's called The Paleo Cardiologist. But as we've been talking about, you know, for the last half hour, there's only two chapters in there that directly relate to the foods that we're eating as far as, you know, are they paleo, non-paleo. The rest of the book is all about how to live healthy in our current world. But it works. I do some vegan and vegetarian bashing in my book because it is very popular these days and very trendy for people to do it. There's no one who loves animals more than I do and more than my wife does. We donate to animal charities and we rescue animals. But the reality is, in order to achieve our best health, we do have to eat meat. Lions and tigers eat meat. Dogs eat meat. Wolves eat meat. And we have to eat some meat also for our best health, just like every other society in the history of the world. So when people do it, they lose weight, they feel great, and they lower their risk of disease, plain and simple.
Doctor, well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. The name of the book is called The Paleo Cardiologist, The Natural Way to Heart Health by Dr. Jack Wolfson. Doctor, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks so much, Jim. It was my pleasure.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Do yourself a favor. I mean, there are a lot of diets out there. Try this. Read a book on paleo. It just makes so much sense, as the doctor just talked there as we were ending. You know, lions, tigers, most of the animals of prey that we see out there, they eat meat. The question is, what kind of meat are you eating? Are you eating meat with a lot of steroids, antibiotics in it, hormones, all those kind of things? Or do you want to eat, you know, what cows were meant to live on, which is basically grass for thousands of years? But do yourself a favor, look into it. And especially if you're running into issues, whether it's heart disease, weight issues, you'd be surprised what can be done. Because you've probably seen some of those diets out there where you measure your food, you count your calories, and we all know none of that works. Well, as always, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.